You're with RN Breakfast, on air and online.
Good morning, this is AM, I'm Chris Yuleman. One of the country's top spy agencies is warning Australian businesses to brace for a wave of cyber attacks around next week's G20 summit in Brisbane. The agency that eavesdrops on the region, the Australian Signals Directorate, won't say where the online assaults are likely to come from. But cyber experts say Russia and China are among the main culprits. Andrew Green reports.
Around Brisbane's CBD, the police barriers are in place and Air Force jets have begun flying training missions in the skies. In the next few days, world leaders will start arriving, and while the physical signs of security are clearly visible, in cyberspace another massive operation is well advanced. In recent weeks, the top secret Australian Signals Directorate, a spy agency based in Canberra, has been giving an increasing number of briefings to Australian industry ahead of the G20 summit. The agency warns that because Australia has assumed the chairmanship of the G20, networks here have become a more attractive target for cyber espionage or attack.
It's just too expensive now for a lot of groups who are anti a lot of G20 issues to, hop on boats, aeroplanes and come to Australia, particularly when a lot of them are being screened now before they get here. So it's much easier and much more cost-effective from their point of view as disruptors to do it in a cyber security way.
Greg Rudd is with Crest Australia, an organisation which provides cyber and information security to individuals and corporate entities. He says with so many high-profile leaders in the country, next weekend's G20 summit is an irresistible target for hackers.
They would love to just get into the traffic light system, for example, and just disrupt that. And what they're after really is free international media.
In its official G20 cyber security advice, the Australian Signals Directorate details various strategies for organisations and individuals to avoid cyber attack. It outlines common techniques used by hackers, including sending emails containing malicious software or hijacking public Wi-Fi networks. The ASD also warns that gifts such as USB sticks are commonly given at events like the G20 and should be avoided because they can secretly install software which can steal sensitive data.
Never use them, never put them in your machine because you'll be putting other things into your computer more than just the stick.
So which groups could be behind the cyber attacks on the G20? Greg Rudd believes there are three broad categories: state-sanctioned hackers, industrial hackers trying to steal commercial secrets, and activist groups such as Anonymous. But in cyberspace, not everyone is who they appear to be.
Because China is a obvious suspect and Russia is an obvious suspect, a lot of the hackers all over the world have gone out of their way and developed it into a bit of an art form to lay the blame at China and Russia's feet for all sorts of hacks.
Greg Rudd from Crest Australia, ending that report by Andrew Green. The Prime Minister Tony Abbott will arrive in Beijing over the weekend, with Australia and China believed to be close to signing off on a free trade agreement soon. Tony Abbott will be in China for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Leaders Meeting. Our China correspondent Steve McDonald has been talking to people familiar with the details of the agreement, and I spoke to him a short time ago. Well, Stephen McDonald, apart from APEC this weekend, Australia's eyes are on the G20 and signing a free trade agreement. So are things getting closer in the lead up to APEC?
Well, in terms of a free trade deal, the people who go into these meetings, and we're now talking dozens rather than the hundreds of negotiators we had, they talk about that they can see the landing zone in their jargon. It means that the mothership, which is the free trade deal, they can see where they need to land this thing down. In their discussions, they talk within amongst themselves, they can see the landing zone. So it means they're close because they want to be able to sign this deal, to make a big deal, to make a big thing of it when President Xi Jinping visits Australia during the G20. And so there are frantic negotiations to finish this off. And basically, it means today is the day, bureaucratically, so that could be announced officially during President Xi Jinping's visit to Australia.
Any idea what's in it?
Well, I've actually been speaking to those who are close to the negotiations, and there are a few interesting things. What they're saying is that, for example, the sugar industry is going to miss out altogether, that the dairy industry is looking for a catch-up provision with the Kiwis. So we want the same deal that New Zealand has, but with some built-in mechanism whereby Australia can catch up in a couple of years very quickly to what the New Zealand agreement is. Apparently the coal tariff is going to be dropped. And they're talking also about the free movement or much freer movement of labour. Now, that would mean, in theory, this would be very controversial, but the Chinese workers could come to Australia. And in theory, that could mean that a Chinese company would be able to build the Brisbane to Melbourne high-speed rail link in a couple of years, for example. Now, that would be very controversial to have workers come from another country to do that sort of thing. But it's one of the things that have got on the table, and the Chinese are keen to push that through. Intellectual property, though, is also apparently a big headache at this stage also in terms of the negotiations.
China correspondent Stephen McDonald. Myanmar, former pariah state, will next week host the most significant international summit in its history. As this year's ASEAN chair, world leaders will descend on the purpose-built capital of Naypyidaw in a sign of just how far Myanmar has come since its brutal military rule. Yesterday, the Nobel laureate and opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi said the country's reform process had stalled and accused the US of being overly optimistic about the chances of further progress. And human rights groups argue it's a nation that still has a long way to go. And two new reports out this week lend weight to that argument. Southeast Asia correspondent Samantha Hawley reports.
Two reports, two disturbing reads. As Myanmar prepares to host world leaders, including the Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott, a spotlight's shining on alleged human rights abuses.
Should a country that is committing war crimes and other abuses with impunity be the head of a regional bloc? I think it's an important question. For sure.
Matthew Smith, the head of human rights group Fortify Rights, doesn't answer that question, but he says extensive research in Kachin State in Myanmar's north shows citizens are being attacked by the army.
The way that they do it is they essentially roll into a village, open fire on civilians. This is done deliberately to force the displacement. It appears to be done deliberately to force the displacement of civilians. So essentially they're forcing people from their homes, they're opening fire, in some cases shooting civilians, wounding, killing civilians.
Fortify Rights says it's documented incidents like this in 2011, 2012 and 2013 in areas where no rebel groups were present. In another study to be officially released this morning, Harvard University researchers have outlined evidence they say could see high-ranking military officers tried for war crimes. One of the report's authors, Matthew Buger, says the findings are based on a three-year study of villages near Thailand's border, where the alleged offences took place between 2005 and 2008.
A very common pattern that we uncovered was a military unit will approach a village and open fire on villagers as they fled. As they ran away, sometimes it would be fire from small weapons, from machine guns or rifles. Occasionally, there would also be mortaring of villages with heavy artillery. Often after villagers fled, the approaching soldiers would destroy the village, destroy agricultural fields or other means of livelihood, and sometimes plant landmines in the village to discourage the return of villagers.
The Myanmar government says during civil war, human rights abuses may have occurred on both sides. This is Samantha Hawley reporting for AM.
And you're listening to AM Around Australia. It's 19 minutes past 7. An expert on terrorist financing says Islamic State is a far greater threat than Al-Qaeda. Economist Loretta Napoleoni says IS acts like a government, raising money from taxes and resources like oil. And the West's policies, such as the Australian government's foreign fighters law, won't work because IS recruits dream of going to the Middle East to be part of an Islamic caliphate led by a supreme religious leader. Sue Lannan's report starts with an excerpt from a Vice News documentary.
This is Raqqa, the capital of the world's newest declared state. A state that's been established by a hardline Sunni jihadist group that emerged out of the mayhem of the Syrian civil war. Until recently, they were known as ISIS, Now they simply call themselves the Islamic State, or IS.
The rise of the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq took the world by surprise. But in a new book about IS called The Islamist Phoenix, economist Loretta Napoleoni says the West was asleep at the wheel.
ISIS was fighting a war by proxy, or at least this is what we thought, against the regime of Assad. And nobody paid any attention to the real plan of the Islamic State, which was, of course, not to fight a war by proxy, but to establish itself as a new power in the region.
And that, Loretta Napoleoni says, makes the Islamic State more dangerous than Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. It has the resources to set up a 21st century caliphate, a state ruled by a supreme religious leader according to Islamic law.
We're talking about maybe between $2 and $4 billion. They're using a sort of structure of finances, which is the structure of a state. Once they conquer a territory, what they do is they establish joint venture with the local population, with the tribal leaders, to run these kind of resources. This is how a state functions. This is not how an armed organization functions.
Islamic State has conquered large parts of eastern Syria and northern and western Iraq. That's given it control over valuable oil fields and water supplies. It makes money from looting, kidnapping for ransom, taxing businesses and selling oil.
The oil sale is important, is smuggling, of course, in small quantities. They estimate it is about $2 million per day in terms of revenues. Most of it goes to Turkey and it's done, again, in joint venture with the local population.
Even Iraq buys grain from the Islamic State because the group controls about 40% of the country's annual wheat production.
The Islamic State has made a deal with the government of Iraq because they control that kind of fundamental food resources.
And can anything be done to crack down on the flow of finance?
There is nothing we can do because, you know, there is no international flow of money. They're not using international banking system. It's a complete model of closed economy. We could have done it in 2011, we could have done it in 2012, but that meant to go to Saudi Arabia, to Kuwait, to Qatar and say, stop funding a war by proxy in Syria.
The dream of an Islamic caliphate has drawn recruits from around the world, including Australia. But Loretta Napoleoni doesn't think the federal government's new foreign fighter laws will work. The laws make it illegal for Australians to go to a conflict zone without a valid reason.
I think the effectiveness of those policies will be very minimal. If somebody wants to go, it will go. The great appeal of the Islamic State is the fact that you can go there and build a new state. So why do you want to go back to Australia if this is your objective?
Expert on terrorist financing Loretta Napoleoni, ending that report by Sue Lannan. And there are reports in the US that President Barack Obama has written a letter to Iran's supreme leader to discuss fighting Islamic State and its nuclear program. The White House won't confirm the correspondence but says its Iran policy hasn't changed and Congress is consulted regularly. Republican leaders have responded bluntly, saying they don't trust Iran. A deadline for Tehran's nuclear program is just weeks away. North America correspondent Michael Vincent reports.
When the US began its attacks against Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, the Obama administration was at pains to repeatedly point out it was not discussing its tactics with Tehran, that Iran was not going to be a member of its coalition fighting Islamic State. Today, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that President Obama wrote a letter a fortnight ago to Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. In the correspondence, he reportedly described a shared interest in fighting Islamic State militants. The journal says Barack Obama stressed that any cooperation was largely contingent on Iran reaching a comprehensive agreement on its nuclear program by November the 24th. White House spokesman Josh Earnest.
I'm not in a position to discuss private correspondence between the president and any world leader. I can tell you that the policy that the president and his administration have articulated about Iran remains unchanged.
The White House says Congress is being briefed on discussions with Iran. Republican Speaker John Boehner says he's not impressed.
Listen, I don't trust the Iranians. I don't think we need to bring them into this. And I would hope that the negotiations that are underway are serious negotiations, but I have my doubts.
Many Republicans campaigned during the midterm elections on the rise of Islamic State and the threat of terrorism. Republican Senator John McCain is critical of the president involving Iran in his Syria strategy.
Somehow we're playing footsie with the Iranians and hope that they will somehow have an effect on ISIS, the sponsors of the 5,000 Hezbollah that came into Syria and changed the balance. This is not a strategy. This is sort of an ad hoc, reactionary failure.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is heading to Amman for direct negotiations with the Iranian foreign minister this Sunday. Much may hinge on Iran's internal politics, which President Obama spoke about just yesterday during his post-election press conference.
There is a long tradition of mistrust between the two countries, and there's a sizable portion of the political elite that, you know, cut its teeth on anti-Americanism and still finds it convenient to blame America for every ill that there is, and whether they can manage to say yes to what clearly would be better for Iran, better for the region, and better for the world is an open question. We'll find out over the next several weeks.
Time is running out for the president. Any deal will have to be approved by the current Democrat-dominated Senate. The Republicans who take over in January have the power to reject it. This is Michael Vincent in Washington for AM.
The private company contracted by the Australian government to set up a clinic in Ebola-stricken Sierra Leone says about 350 health workers have already registered their interest in staffing it. Aspen Medical says around half the applicants are Australian, but most staff will be recruited in Africa. Sydney nurse Garth Healy is putting his hand up to help. He's previously served with the New Zealand Defence Force at a field hospital in East Timor. He spoke with AM's Samantha Donovan.
I just see an emergency unfolding that's going to possibly be a global emergency that's going to affect everyone. And if we don't help now, I mean, it's going to be too late. So this is our opportunity to actually help.
Do you worry about contracting the virus yourself, though?
I'd probably worry about contracting other things in a country like that. I mean, if you look at how many people have actually helped and how many people who actually have contracted Ebola, it's not that many. There's a lot of fear around it, but, you know, there's things like malaria, which kill, you know, 1.2 million people a year, that you'd be more worried about in some of those countries.
How do your friends and family feel about the fact that you're wanting to put your hand up and go?
They think I'm crazy. I'm very worried about me catching it, coming back sick or not coming back at all. But again, it's something that I think needs to happen.
You've been deployed as a nurse with the New Zealand Army. What do you think of the Australian government contracting a private company to run this new field clinic?
Well, I think it's an option that they have, and it's a really good first step, a very safe step to be able to do this. They can keep their reserves and see how it goes. Now, I would be a little bit concerned about the model that they're using. Now, especially if you have a look at something like England and their field hospital, 22 field hospital, they've been training for weeks and weeks and weeks to provide a clinic over in Sierra Leone. And just say, let's sort of contract a private company and within a couple of weeks we'll have people on the ground. I don't understand what they're actually trying to achieve. So it's a really good first step, but I'm a bit confused about where is it going.
Do you think Australia would have been better off deploying what's known as the OSMAT team, the special team trained up in Darwin for emergency medicine?
As long as there was a reserve team that could be trained up at exactly the same time, yes.
Aspen Medical has said that most of the people who work in this clinic will be from Africa. They'll be hired locally. Are you concerned that Australians who want to go may not be able to go?
No, I don't think so. Australia has a lot of really highly skilled nurses and doctors. And again, I don't understand the model of why we're not sending people over there to give a hand. But again, they need to be trained. There's a misunderstanding that people can just go and put a hazmat suit on and go and treat people. It's a lot more complicated than that. My experience is you need to get in partnership with, you know, the organisations that are on the ground, people like Médecins Frontières and Médecins du Monde and Doctors Without Borders and UNICEF, and really get in a partnership with them. And I hope they have to say, what response do you actually need?
Sydney nurse Garth Healy speaking with Samantha Donovan. And in finance, Wall Street has edged higher after the European Central Bank signalled it would take more action to kickstart the flatlining Eurozone economy. European markets moved higher as well on those comments. And a short time ago, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 0.3%. The Dow Jones trading at 17,538 points, up 53 points. And the dollar is buying 85.7 US cents. I'm Chris Yulman, and that is AM for today.